So we read a lot of books at WGN Radio, so much so now, the staff, that we are posting every month our book club. Sarah Tiemann leads the charge. She's the big reader and works real hard on this webpage for us, among other things. And so Steve Alexander, Bob Kessler, and I will tell you what we're reading. Steve Bertrand contributes as well. And we know a lot of you like to read, so it's fun to have monthly chats about that. And we just share some of our books for you, because maybe those are some good suggestions, and we appreciate yours. I have maybe unusual taste. I tend to read only nonfiction. I remember I read The Orchid Thief, which a lot of people did. That was a bestseller, and it was all about orchids and people that stole orchids. And I read The Feather Thief, which is about people that are into feathers and stole feathers. And then there was the book The Falcon Thief, which was about people who steal falcon eggs because they're into falcons. In our conversation with that author at the time, he told us that those peregrine falcons will dive bomb at their prey. And how fast do you think a falcon will go when it's dive bombing for prey? Anyone?
I'll say 100 miles an hour.
160 to Whoa. 170 Whoa. Miles an hour.
Wow.
How is that possible? The guy that wrote that book also wrote The Badass Librarians of Timbuktu, which is just a fun thing to say. It's about some badass librarians in Timbuktu. And so these stories, even if you don't care about orchids or feathers or falcons or librarians, you kind of learn a little bit about the world. The trick is to weave enough intrigue into these kinds of stories to make them fun to read and feel like you got something. And now there's this. The Mesopotamian Riddle, an archaeologist, a soldier, a clergyman, and the race to decipher the world's oldest writing. And it's by the same guy that wrote The Badass Librarians of Timbuktu. That was a bestseller on the New York Times list. Tells you something about how some people can find the intrigue and then relay it to you. And so that's Joshua Hammer. And we invited him back today to tell us that story as well. Joshua, how are you? You're on WGN.
I am well. I am happy to be here. I am happy.
How do you find your stories, man?
Well, you know, there was a five-year gap between Falcon Thief and this one, so it was a struggle. It was during the COVID years where nobody was going anywhere. You know, to make a long story short, I've always been fascinated by languages and decipherment. I read a great book about hieroglyphs. In fact, I reviewed it for the New York Times a few years ago. Then I stumbled across a guy named Austin Layard, an archaeologist. I mentioned him in my last book, The Falcon Thief, because he was the guy who came up with the first, the oldest pictorial representation of falconry in these archaeological ruins in northern Iraq from about 2,500 years ago. So everything, and he ended up being the main character in my current book. So it all sort of came together. I mean, cuneiform, which predated hieroglyphs. When I started looking into this, I wasn't even sure if the writing had ever actually been deciphered. So little I knew about it, but I did a little more digging and got really caught up in the story.
Obviously,
yeah,
your research is impressive here. It struck me as so much homework, so much learning to do, and then figuring out how you can make it accessible for somebody like me.
That's totally correct. That was the challenge, to make this story. You know, parts of the story are pretty accessible. I mean, the story of a guy who wanders off to Mesopotamia, to the Ottoman Empire in the mid-19th century, and uncovers a lost civilization from, you know, buried beneath the sands, that's just a fascinating tale. But then the second quest was finding those inscriptions and trying to figure out what they said. And that was a lot more difficult. It was a lot more challenging to make. You know, that you run the risk of just becoming sort of lost in the details and losing your audience. So I was very conscious that I had to make this understandable and accessible to the average reader who was like me, because I didn't know anything about this
Well,
stuff.
Didn't the Rosetta Stone do that? I saw that at the British Museum last year, and I know you reference it a few times in your book,
yeah,
even at the
absolutely.
Very end.
So absolutely.
And the Rosetta Stone, as I thought I saw it, was amazingly fine, detailed, neat carving on a stone, but in three languages, one of which was accessible to modern man. So as you go back in time, I thought that unlocked everything. It did or
no.
It didn't?
No, it didn't. It unlocked hieroglyphs because those were the three languages were ancient Greek, which, you know, was still being taught in schools at that time, right? So everybody could read it. I mean, anybody who was an educated person could read ancient Greek. And then hieroglyphs, the language of the holy writing of the pharaohs, and then there was something called Demotic, which was like a hieroglyph shorthand for non-pharaonic readers and writers. So having that ancient Greek was the key to everything, right? Because they could just match up letters and sounds and begin to unravel these two other unknown writings, unknown languages. And it was having that accessible writing and language that made it all possible. But that was only good for hieroglyphs. It didn't solve the other problems. That didn't open up the world. World of cuneiform at all. It was a completely different story.
And cuneiform, if I were to describe it, is a series of lines. Sometimes they look like Y's that are filled in, maybe triangles on their side, dots.
Yeah, it's kind of wedge. You know, cuneiform is Latin for wedge. So they're kind of, you know, what they did was they took these reeds, these from the wetlands of Mesopotamia, and they cut them. They cut the stalks, and it created this kind of triangular end tip. And then they would press those into clay, and they would roll them around. So you had various wedges, long wedges, short wedges, but all of them were wedges. And then they would just put them into different patterns, some of them incredibly complex. You know, you could have one character with like 12, 14 of these wedges. A couple could be, you know, you could have a single wedge. There were innumerable combinations. And, you know, it wasn't a beautiful writing. It wasn't like hieroglyphs where you had all these recognizable, hieroglyphs. You could go back and look. You have stalks of barley. You have vultures. You have human eyes, noses, whatever. Lots of representations of pictorial, of existing objects. Cuneiform was completely abstract. So that was one of the first problems, is that nobody had any sense what this stuff was. Just imagine seeing walls covered with essentially gibberish and trying to grapple with that.
Yeah.
And figure out how to. It's like an amazing challenge. And I think that's what, you know, that challenge just kind of captured my imagination as much as the discovery of these lost palaces under
sand. And it is, I'm glad you saw it as absurd as I did too, or complicated. You would think even the people that came up with this, the one guy would turn to the other and go, hey, Steve, this is nonsense. We got to come up with something a little more streamlined here.
Well, you would think so, but they didn't. And not only was that one of the problems, but the main issue was that once they started deciphering this writing, particularly the writing of the ancient empire of Assyria, the Assyrio-Babylonian version of cuneiform, because cuneiform was actually used for a lot of different languages, but the Holy Grail was Assyro-Babylonian because that was a great empire with a great history. And when they started to attack this writing, this language, they realized bit by bit that one of these symbols could have multiple meanings, 7, 8, even 10 different sounds, and they had no. It could be used as a syllable. It could be used as a letter. It could be used as a silent character, or it could be used as a logogram. In other words, standing for a full word, a concept.
Right.
So they had to wrestle with this. It's an unbelievable challenge.
Without getting into all of the details about how they did it, didn't you write that one of the breakthroughs was that they noticed that some symbols or series of symbols that they would see would be associated with famous people? And so they go, okay, that represents that person, and maybe now at least we have a breakthrough of a word or two. Is that right?
That's kind of the way, well, that's the way that they broke hieroglyphs, and that's also the way that they broke cuneiform, because once you, lots of names, proper names, pretty much sound the same in any language, right? So if you can figure out, if you have trilingual, you know, different inscriptions, three inscriptions in different languages, and you can get the name in one language, then you can kind of look for the search for the parallel in another one of those writings,
right,
and figure out what it says. It's tricky. It's, you know, it's extremely, you know, it's an incredibly obscure and recondite skill that very few people in the world have.
A recondite skill. Well, somebody's going to go to a thesaurus after this show. I just want to also point this out. You point out in the book, and I think it was very helpful, a timeline, all dates be before Christ, And you have sort of a history of language as you've come to dissect it. And you say from 4,500 to 4,000 B.C., settlements form along the lower Euphrates River. The region will become known as Sumer. In 3,400, the first proto-writing appears in the Sumerian city of Uruk, U-R-U-K. 3,400 B.C. Now, that sounds like a real long time ago, and it is. But human beings have existed and coexisted for much, 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 much longer than that. Are you telling me that over the whole course of human history, only that recently have we said, hey, we ought to write that down? There ought to be a way to...
Yeah, I am telling you, this is a pretty recent development in the history of mankind.
Written language.
Yes.
I mean, just think
written
about
language.
How instrumental it is now. And in a
amazing.
Way, in a way, they had emojis before we did. At least the hieroglyphs were, right? That was a symbol. It was a wink. You know what I'm saying?
Kind of, yeah. I mean, the original... I would say that the original writing, these proto-writing, were emojis. You know, they didn't attempt to replicate speech. That was a later development. That came like 1,000 years later. But in 3,400 B.C., they came up with the idea. You know, life was getting complicated. There were cities being built, 20, 30,000 people. Imagine trying to do business deals and keep it all in your head. It just didn't work. So I think that the complexity and the growth of these of these cities forced them to come up with a system. You know, it was a necessity. They had to keep track of this stuff.
Okay.
So in those days, it was just a bunch of, it was just a list, you know, and then it evolved into a into representing a language.
Maybe that's why I'm such a nerd's not the right word, but I don't use emoji because, my career has been in language, and I'm not saying I'm the best talker or writer or anything, but I do think there's a certain beauty to words well-crafted and appreciated, and the people just, you know, do two little symbols on my phone as a way of communicating is efficient, and I got the message, but I'm just going to be a ball buster about that. And one last thing. Let's take a break and then come back, because, well, that's kind of the backdrop of the story. You're writing about the three guys that competitively sort of unraveled this thing. And I've said that at times it's almost a Indiana Jones type story. I think I used swashbuckling at one point. And one other thing that you learn in your book is just how awful some of those civilizations were. Mesopotamian riddle, an archaeologist, a soldier, a clergyman, and the race to decipher the world's oldest writing. Joshua Hammer's latest. You know, one other thing that you're also reminded, Joshua, in your very interesting book is how the British raided the Middle East for not just the Rosetta Stone, but all sorts of artifacts, right?
Oh, yeah. I don't think the British Museum is going to be wildly happy with my book. Well, you know, they've been getting a lot of heat over the last couple of years, and I think, some would accuse me of piling on, but you can't avoid it. When you're talking about the archaeologists that traveled around that part of the world in the 19th century, I mean, yes, it was just one sort of looting expedition after another.
And was it also because the British, still as an empire, exerted enough influence on the world that some of these countries were unhappily compliant with the raiding of this stuff? They knew it was being taken, right?
It sure feels that way to me. This is one of the obscure things. You can never really find out what the transactional arrangements were, but it seems like there was a lot of pressure. The Ottoman Empire, from which a lot of things were taken, was pretty weak, faltering empire, losing territory, and the British were kind of, you know, allies in a way. But I think as part of it, there was also extortionists. You know, you want to stay on our good side, you give us this, you give us that, you give us this, and the Sultan was quite willing to comply in almost all these cases. Yeah,
that sort of leverage reminds me of. Oh, never mind. Okay, well then, tell us a little bit about these guys who were battling with each other.
I pulled up a quote. Do you want me to talk about this the evil empire that you were referring to before the break? Because I pulled up a quick quote from the book.
Yeah.
About the Assyrian Empire, where a British historian said like a few dozen years ago that the empire, quote, must surely have among the worst press notices of any state in history. Their famous rulers rate in the popular imagination just below Adolf Hitler and Genghis Khan for cruelty, violence, and sheer murderous savagery. So I don't think, I think he's giving them a fair assessment. This was a warrior empire. It extended itself through warfare. They generally would, they demanded tributes from various vassal states. If vassals failed to comply or stalled, they would send out their highly trained highly equipped armies lay siege to these cities and then just slaughter people. If you look at the Old Testament, these stories of sieges and torture and killing of the Jewish states in those days are very well documented.
Torture's the right word. And some of this stuff is Game of Thrones-ish. I mean, it's just...
Oh, yeah.
It's bizarre. tell me a story about one of these guys, though, that is most intriguing to you.
Well, I think the worst of the worst may have been Ashurbanipal. Ashurbanipal was the last king of the Assyrian Empire. And he's notorious for he had a rivalry going with his brother. His brother was quite jealous because Ashurbanipal was younger, but became emperor. He just got relegated to become governor of Babylon. Ashurbanipal didn't trust him. He sent his army there. They besieged the city for a couple of years. Basically, people starved to death by the thousands.
Yeah.
And then finally, Ent broke down the walls and killed everybody who was still alive. So that was pretty typical of, I know, including Ashurbanipal's brother. That seemed to be the modus operandi for, unfortunately, for the Assyrians. They also created some great art and did a few good things.
I've described your Indiana Jones type intrepid decipherers as going out into this world, not at that time in the 1800s, but they would have to, you know, swing from ropes to look at writings on a wall or on the side of a hill or something.
Yeah, that was my first decipherer was a guy named Henry Rawlinson, who found this giant cliffside carving in the old Persian Empire and had to basically shinny up a sheer face cliff, perch on a very narrow ledge, put a ladder on top, and then climb up this ladder on this narrow ledge and spend hours there copying down these inscriptions. Somehow he did this, and basically he was the guy who made the first major steps in understanding cuneiform. But it was an incredible feat, and he was the only one who succeeded. Others had tried and failed. Finally, they just wrote it off as impossible, and then Rawlinson managed to pull it off.
Today, you would just fly a drone up there, take a picture of it, bring it down and look at it. But no, they had
to—they
had to actually physically assess these things and then make etchings or renderings of them. And so that's just another way to appreciate the book, the history, the physical challenge of doing it, the mental challenge of doing it. And then what do you know? Somebody was able to figure out, I have a minute left, but was there a breakthrough moment in this most ancient language for these guys?
I'm not sure if there was. It was really a sort of a succession of breakthroughs, but in 1857, there was still a lot of doubt about whether this was actually decipherable. The scholars were saying, hey, these guys, these so-called decipherers are carrying out a hoax. And so they had a big challenge in 1857 where four guys who claimed to have cracked Assyro-Babylonian would all attempt to decipher a 2,500-year-old, 3,000-year-old relic independently, send in their decipherment, and then judges would compare them.
Yeah.
He would send them in seals envelope. And that sort of definitively proved, hey, they've done it. But it was pretty dramatic, you know, the events leading up to that. And that's how I begin the book, and that's how I kind of end the book. I mean, bookend the story. Yeah.
Joshua Hammer, I'm glad you're doing what you do, man, because I don't know anybody else that would take this topic on. And I may be crazy for telling my radio listeners, hey, we're going to talk about Mesopotamia at 11:30. But it's really a fun read, and it's always fun to talk to you, Joshua.
It's always fun talking to you. Talk to you again in the next couple of years. Don't know what I'm coming up with next, but
I'm going to take this conversation. We'll post it as a podcast at WGNradio.com after the show. You can hear it, share it with your friends. I'll ask the staff here, though, to also post the last conversation about the falcon egg thing, because that's insane. The last book you wrote, we'll put that next to it, because it's always fun to hear you. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, John. Appreciate it. Thanks for your interest.
The book is called The Mesopotamian Riddle.